You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations peoples' connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. This week you're here with Kev and Katie. Last week was Kev and Kent. There's a K thing going on here. Katie, how are you?
I'm excellent. How are you, Kevin?
I'm very good, thanks. There's three Ks there. I'm not going to go there.
No, please don't.
No, I'm not going to at all. Other than to say that K is a special letter, and that's why sometimes I have special K for breakfast, because it just makes me feel good about my name. Radio MMT with Katie and Kev this week. That was one of the dumbest intros I've ever done. How are you, Katie?
I'm excellent, excellent. Spending a lot of time at 3CR and getting to know people. It's a very friendly and convivial place.
Yes, it's an excellent community, 3CR. I feel very straight and white here in the 3CR community.
You and me both.
I'm not entirely straight, but comparatively speaking, there's so much variety of cultures and stuff here. It's just lovely. It's a great place, an excellent environment, and I really enjoy being here. It helps my mind. This week, we are going to continue our conversation in macroeconomics about banking. I spoke with Kent last week, two weeks ago when we did the show, last episode, I should say, and we talked around banking and we kind of raised some interesting points. I think the thing which we came away with from the last episode was that banking is essentially a service to help ordinary citizens time shift their spending capability. If you don't have enough money to buy a house, then you use bank credit to assist you in some of the larger purchases that would take some time to otherwise achieve. That was kind of the main thing that I took away from our last episode. But I want to go back and dissect it a bit more, just to separate some of the components of the economy. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, Katie, because you're more educated than I am. I come into this as a purposefully as a layperson, whereas you study this stuff and you have access to greater minds than I do. Would it be fair to say that the two main types of money in the economy are fiat currency, which is to say that money is spent by the government into existence when it pays for things like military or infrastructure and that sort of stuff. And that's what we call, I don't know, hard currency or the most stable form of currency. Would that be right?
Yeah, there's lots of terms. There's terms like vertical money, high-powered money, but it's basically the money that the government directly issues, which comes down to cash and the bank's own deposits at the Reserve Bank of Australia. You might, if you want to be loose with the definition of money, start to expand it further to things like government bonds and so on. But mostly, when you talk about money, you're talking about, like, if someone in your household says, I'm off down the shops, and you ask, do you have any money?
Yep.
you both know what you're talking about. Right. You're not necessarily talking about government bonds.
True, and we'll get to bonds. Bonds is one of the most confusing things in our economy, but it's also quite simple when you understand it. It took me a long time. That's an episode down the track. So that's like fair currency. So if I go down to the shop, I've got $10 in my pocket. That's hard government currency. It's irrefutable. Everybody knows what it is. And there you go. The other form of money, and there's actually more of this money in the economy than there is the hard currency, is my understanding, is that bank credit, which is essentially a citizen's ability to purchase things with money that they don't have yet, but will have in the future, and that's the credit arrangement that the banks have with their customers.
Yeah. Basically, credit relationships are, you know, the delivery of something now in return for the promise to deliver something later. So what you do if you have like $200 weighing you down in your pocket, which doesn't happen often, not to me anyway, you can deposit it at the bank, and many people assume, stick it in a drawer with your name on it.
Right.
They it's gone. Yeah. It's no longer yours. It belongs to the bank. And what you have in exchange is bank credit. You have the balance in your bank account, which is the bank's promise to provide you with government money again under the terms of you having that account.
And so if you deposited $200, then that's one arrangement where the bank would certainly credit you $200 because you've deposited with them, so there's a direct record of that. But most credit is an arrangement where the bank will check your credit worthiness, and you can have no money with the bank, but they have done a credit check on you, and they understand that you have an income earning capacity, and that you will be able to pay that money back in the future because you've met their credit worthy checks, and that's probably the more prevalent form of credit in the economy rather than withdrawing against a balance that's already there. So I want to go through this and I want to separate things up. So if we understand that the two main sources of money in the economy are government money, we're going to call it government money, which is the same as calling it fiat currency, which is the same as calling it public money. We'll call it public money because all money that is created by the government is there for the public. So that's one form of money. Then we've got the bank credit, which is another form of money. Now, if we only had government money, and we had no bank credit, there are no banks set up, what would the economy look like? We'd have the government spending. I'm going to use practical examples because I want to keep this really simple. So the government creates money when it pays for things like its military or it pays for infrastructure projects. And so it says, rightio, we've got 10,000 soldiers to pay. We're going to pay them. It's Friday. We're going to pay them. And they'll go to a computer and they'll knock out transfers for all the soldiers to be paid. And that money is new money that's been created, and it's injected into the economy as those soldiers' accounts are credited with the money that's been created by the government and deposited into their accounts. Yep. Bingo, new money. It enters the economy and it filters through the economy. The soldiers go to the supermarket and they spend some money. Supermarket employs people so that the soldiers' money then becomes the supermarket people's money, and then they go to get some new tyres for their car, and you can see money filtering through the economy. So the government spends it into the economy and then it filters its way through as people buy things.
Yeah, and it's very important to remember that the only way that you have those supermarkets or whatever else in the private sector that can function like that is that the government is spending more money than it taxes.
Yeah.
Otherwise there is no money to facilitate those transactions and those private sector institutions simply can't exist.
And so when a government is spending more money into the economy than it's taxing out, it's running deficits. So yep. So an economy is dependent overall for governments to run deficits as they normally do. Occasionally they knock up a surplus here and there, but generally speaking, if governments didn't run deficits, the economy would collapse. I think that's a reasonably safe general statement to make. Might be some complications if we're talking about Norway and some other places, but in general terms, a government has to spend more into the economy than it taxes out so that there's a supply of money to form an economy, including the private sector economy.
I mean, essentially, if you want to have a private sector, you have to have government deficit spending. If you don't deficit spend, then the economy is simply like the Soviet economy. The only transactions you can have are between the government and individuals.
Which I kind of like that idea. I need to think about it a bit more. That's because I've turned into a raving socialist over time.
It's hanging around this place, Kev.
See, that's why I like this place. I can say I'm a raving socialist. I'm going to the footy later on with a mate of mine that I haven't seen for a very long time. I haven't been to the footy in years. Mm-hmm. He's a raving capitalist, right? And I know that he's going to introduce me to his friends. And he's going to say, oh, Kev, what have you been up to? And I go, I've just been at 3CR just, you know, spouting, socialist stuff. And they're going to look at me like I'm the devil. So I enjoy those conversations. Anyway, the government is spending into the economy. It's creating private markets. And it might be that you're a supermarket and you've got a supplier and the supplier says, I want to be paid for this stuff. And the supermarket says, well, we can't pay for it yet because we haven't sold it yet. So we'll create 30-day terms for you, 60-day terms, 90-day terms. So you can still run your economy just with government money without taking out loans if you set up terms so that people get paid down the line, etc. And you've still got an economy. So there's no bank credit at this stage, and you're still running your economy. Suppliers are being paid to 30 days or 60 days, and we're all living happily. Except that then something expensive comes up, like a car or a house or something, and it's going to take too long to save up for that particular item that you want. If you're going to enjoy the use of it, you know, you need the car now, you need the house now, so you're going to need to borrow to achieve that. Well, you might find somebody in the economy who's got enough cash to lend you, but we have these things called banks. And so then you go to a bank and you take out a loan. You take out a loan for your car or your house. And as we were explaining on the show last week, there's a misinformed view that banks lend out deposits that they've received through the economy elsewhere, so that somebody, Mr. Supermarket owner, might have quite a lot of money and he deposits that in the bank, and so the general understanding is that these deposits form the basis for loans to be made out to other people. And as Kent and I said in the last episode, and as you and I will say in this episode, Katie, that's just misinformed. There's no substance to that that model or that that system of loaning. It's just not true.
Yeah, it's entirely back to front. I mean, it posits that money has come from somewhere, we don't know where, and anyway, it's not particularly interesting. But it's a commodity like any other sort of commodity, like apples, like corn, steel,
yeah. Whatever. So the only requirement that a bank has to make a loan, as we said previously, was to credit check the customer to make sure that they can pay that back. They'll be paying back that money with fiat currency, public money, that they receive in the future, and they'll be paying back the principal and interest on top of that. And it's entirely dependent on the government spending into the economy to provide those funds that people can use to repay the loans that makes the credit available in the first place. So here we've got an economy, we've got the government spending into the economy, we've got some banks set up, we've got some customers coming in who meet the creditworthy requirements. The bank says, here you go, here's 50 grand for a car. I used to say 10 grand for a car, but now it's like 50 grand for a car. And I used to say, here's a couple hundred grand for a house. That's now, more like a couple of million. It's just insane. Anyway, that's how it goes. And the economy is rolling along fine. Let's see what happens when we remove fiat currency from the economy. Let's see what happens when the government stops spending into the economy, and that the only money that's available is bank credit.
So let's say the government is doing what it's promised, and it's delivering a stunning run of public surpluses.
Yes, which is actually what they did do under the Howard and Costello governments in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I looked into this quite a lot. It was quite interesting. What becomes apparent straight away is that if the government isn't spending into the economy, or if worse, if the government is running a government surplus, it's no longer, if it runs a balance budget, there's no new money entering the economy, and the only money in the economy is there, and that's it. If they run a surplus, they actually shrink the economy, and if they shrink the economy, there's usually a recession, or in the case of the Howard and Costello surpluses, there was a huge expansion of private debt, of people borrowing from the banks. And it's kind of ludicrous when you think about it, because when you understand that the government money is required to meet the creditworthiness of a customer, to think that all these conservative and orthodox institutions keep on crowing on about wanting government surpluses when it's completely against their interest. If a bank says that they think that the government should run surpluses and that would be, responsible financial management, they're shooting themselves in the foot. They're saying that you're going to starve citizens of access to money. And so if governments are running surpluses, the banks should be saying, well, we're not lending to anybody because how the hell are they going to pay it back?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the long term, they're destroying the economy, but how many businesses these days operate in the long term? In the short term, if the government's not spending enough, then the only other source of maintaining
the economy
of liquid funds is bank credit.
Yeah.
So in the short term, they can start to raise interest rates that they charge for this facility, and they have the public over a barrel. There's nowhere else they can go.
Yeah, it is interesting. When this was pointed out to me that there's always a contraction in the economy after when a government runs a surplus, I had to go back and have a bit of a look. And Keating ran surpluses during his time, and there we had a recession. Howard and Costello ran successive surpluses, and private debt absolutely exploded. There was a fair amount of economic optimism around at that time because there was a lot of deregulation and a lot of white shoe people with shiny things around their necks and on their fingers.
A hell of a lot of privatisation. So people who had money or had access to credit could buy up totally safe public assets and start, price gouging.
Yeah, but what we saw after the Howard and Costello surpluses was the GFC. Now, they were part of a worldwide kind of optimism, and the GFC was a response to that. It just collapsed. It collapsed economies, and it disappoints me that the Costello surpluses the result of that was hidden in the GFC, because had Australia been rolling along at that particular time, the GFC never occurred, there still would have been a contraction, which would have been far more obvious, except that it was kind of hidden by the GFC in total. And so it sort of went, Labor sort of got had to clean up the mess with that. But something bad was going to happen, was always going to happen. It just happened in the middle of the GFC.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The more recent one I quite like is the Chalmers talking about some of the surpluses at the Labor government. And they've been crowing on about this, going, we've had these surpluses, blah, blah, blah. And then you look at the figures, and the figures display that there was a per capita GDP recession, which is to say that the only reason that the economy kept on expanding during these surpluses was that the population was growing. And so there were more people, and with more people, these people had money, so that the overall effect was that the economy was growing. But when you divided the economy by the number of people in it, it was actually shrinking. Each person had less than they had the year before. So the per capita GDP was receding, even though there were surpluses, because there was an expanding population. It was the only thing that kept the GDP rising.
Yeah, and it's important to look at where the government cuts spending in order to achieve these surpluses. Generally, it's in cutting spending on public programs that benefit the poorest part of the population. They don't cut subsidies or incentives to the wealthy.
Ah, yeah.
So So, I mean, what happens is that you have a recession that, you know, the top 10% of the population simply don't feel.
No. In fact, they often benefit from these sorts of things. And we'll get onto this in the second half of the show when we talk about monetary policy and interest rates. So we've got an economy and the government has stopped spending into it. Let's say it's running a balanced budget and... So, actually, I've never really thought about this. I always just think about the government's not spending anything at all. But let's say that they're running a balanced budget and there's no extra money going to the economy. I had this kind of Damascus moment a couple of years ago. I had to call Anne straight away when I thought about it. It had to do with loans. And because such a large part of the economy is driven by credit, it's quite confusing because you've got loans, new loans coming in and old ones being paid off, and there's this continuing cycle of money entering and leaving, and it's kind of confusing. But it simply occurred to me that just from the interest alone, if I went to the bank and I borrowed $100 and I went to you, Katie, I want to buy something for you for $100. What have you got for sale for $100? Can you sell me some hooch or something like that? No, let's say tomatoes, right? Because we don't, hooch is not...
We all are clean livers here at 3CR.
We're all clean livers. Let's just say if it was medicinal and for the public good, right? That's irrelevant. So you've now got $100. I've got the product. The product is consumed and I owe $100. And I owe $100 to the bank and they are going to charge me $110 for the privilege of lining that. $100 for the principal and $10 for the interest. So if I only lived in a credit economy, I would then have to go to another lending institution and say, can you lend me, or somebody else would, if I could find that money from somewhere in the economy and it's only bank credit, somebody is going to have to say, well, if I'm going to satisfy this loan, I'm going to have to find $110 from somewhere. And so somebody else is going to have to borrow $110, which I would then come by. I would pay back my loan with the interest. That's great. There's $100 in the economy, which you've got. There's $110 that I've satisfied, so the bank's got $10 profit. But somebody down the line now owes $110. Well, they could go and borrow $110 from somebody else, but they're going to have to pay interest on top of that. And I thought, this is like a Ponzi scheme. And it doesn't matter how many loans there are, and it doesn't matter how much they're circulating, the principle is the same. Each loan requires more money than the loan itself to satisfy the requirements of that loan.
Yeah.
It's got to come from somewhere. If you're borrowing money to pay interest, that's just a recipe for disaster. And if you're borrowing money just to pay back the principal, that's not sustainable. So money has to come into the economy from somewhere else for loans to have an existence. And I thought, well, there's only one other place that money comes into the economy, and that's when the government spends it into the economy. So you can't have a banking credit system unless you have a government spending into the economy and running deficits to service all of those loans.
Yeah, ultimately, if the government is not spending at a level that maintains the level of private sector surplus, that is new money coming into the private sector to support economic activity, including supporting the financial system. The only way that this can go on for any length of time is that if it's powered by some sort of speculative bubble, which ultimately has to crash. And when it crashes, you have what's called a liquidity crisis. You have private financial institutions which are not prepared to lend anymore because they're all too gun-shy all of a sudden.
Because there's too much risk there.
Yeah,
there's no way of assuring that anybody's going to get paid back because all you're doing is creating more and more debt. But that's when the institutions start thinking, hang on, who's going to be left holding the bathwater at the end of this whole thing? And the more apparent that becomes, the less enthusiastic lenders become in lending anything. So.
Yeah, so essentially the entire economy shuts down. If you can't sell anything, you're in trouble. If you don't have the finance as a firm to sustain not only long-term investment but also short-term production costs, then you're out of business.
Yeah. So there we have it. We have government spending into the economy with no credit, and the economy can run if you have terms of trade. It might be hard to purchase some more expensive items, unless of course you had a socialist government that provided housing and assisted with all these basic things. Then you could run an economy without credit if you had a good cooperative government that was interested in the public good, which would be lovely, wouldn't it? That would be nice. But that's called socialism, Katie, and then we'll be tarred and feathered and run out of town.
Well, I mean, you could do it simply with the government providing credit.
We talked about this a bit on the last show, right? Yep. Because banks charge so much interest, they create a further hardship for people to meet credit requirements. And I'm going to use an example that you and I are both well aware of. We're both rent payers. I've paid rent for many, many years of my life. If all the money that I had spent in rent I could have put towards buying a property, I could afford a property and I wouldn't have to be a renter. But because I can never reach that threshold with the banks and because of the interest that they're charging, that money goes to somebody else. Mm. This is what we're talking about with a government-run bank or nationalising the banks. If the banks were not for profit and the only thing that they did, let's say they were run by the government, and this sounds crazy, but this is what the Chifley government was looking at in 1947, 48, 49. How about we nationalise the banks and the government runs the banks? Then the government doesn't need money, doesn't need to make a profit. It can just facilitate the time-shifting operations of its customers to help them.
Yeah, as I was saying earlier, the government creates the private sector by creating that slack space in the economy that surplus savings in the private sector creates. Now, how much of our needs are satisfied by the private sector is determined entirely by how much of this space the government wants to give to the private sector to operate. So this is entirely a policy choice of the government. Like, the government could say, well, look, we don't see a reason to have a private financial sector at all, including private banks, and they could just provide those services directly. But that's a policy choice. Or it can say we're going to have a mixed economy with both private and public players in it in finance, which we had with the Commonwealth Bank operating since, I think, 1911.
Now, I'm going to read you something here because I did a very basic investigation into Ben Chifley, and I found this. It says, following World War II, the Australian Labor government, led by Prime Minister Ben Chifley, sought to nationalise private banks primarily to ensure permanent government control over the national economy and to prevent a recurrence of the Great Depression. Now, this is also just after World War II, so the government's well aware of their fiscal capacity because they had to fund a war. So they understand currency creation and mobilising resources, and monetary policy had nothing to do with it. It's all about fiscal policy. So it says, the key motivations for this move included preventing future depressions. Labor blamed private banks for worsening the 1930s Great Depression by restricting credit and refusing to lend to governments. That doesn't make any sense to me because they don't need to lend to governments. So we'll just ignore that bit.
They don't need to lend to the federal government, but they probably
to state government,
local governments.
That's good. So I got this off the interweb, and it might have a few mistakes, and that's our job, is to pick up the mistakes as we go along. Okay, so that's So it says, and by restricting credit and refusing to lend to state governments, let's just say, rightio. Nationalisation was seen as a way to cushion the economy against future global downturns by allowing the state to manage credit. Okay, post-war reconstruction. Chifley viewed a government-owned banking monopoly as a vital tool for managing the transition from a war footing to a peaceful, prosperous economy focused on full employment and large-scale national projects, which they did for 30 years. Their employment was down below 2%. It was not this bogus full employment we have now with the NAIRU. It was genuine full employment, with the only unemployment being transitory. It was temporary. So there you go. It says loss of wartime controls. During the war, the government had temporary power over private banks. When the High Court began striking down post-war legislation like Section 48 of the Banking Act 1945, that's to all of you banking nerds out there, and I know there's a couple of you who've been to this sort of stuff, that tried to make these controls permanent. Chifley decided to nationalise the banks entirely to bypass further legal challenges. So my understanding was that he wanted to nationalise the banks. He came up against some constitutional barriers, and he wanted to get around those by doing that sort of thing. Okay, and this is ideological beliefs. He says the socialist objective had been part of Labor's platform since 1921. That's a contentious statement. There's this whole thing about whether Labor, how socialist Labor is. Some people say they were, other people say they weren't.
Oh, look, some people say the only socialist in the world is themselves.
Yes. So. I think Lenin said that that Labor wasn't a socialist party back in the early 1900s. He said, no, they're a Laborist movement. They're not a socialist movement. Anyway, so I'll say this. The socialist objective had been part of Labor's platform since 1921, reflecting a deep distrust of money power and the belief that essential financial services should be operated for the public interest rather than private profit. So I love that. And it says the attempt ultimately failed after the Banking Act 1947 was declared unconstitutional by the High Court and the Privy Council. This controversy contributed significantly to Labor's defeat in the 1949 election. Mm. Oh, that would have been nice if that got up, though. It would be a completely different world.
There's a general principle in there that's not bad at all.
Yeah.
Where the government provides space for the private sector to operate, it ought to be operating in the public interest.
But
and if it's not, the government has every right to take away the space that it's given them to play in.
But the government's been fooled into this subservient role that it now has, and it's scared of its own shadow. Like, you look at the current Albanese Labor government compared to the Chifley government back then. They had some gumption, some ambition, but it all seems to have evaporated. Hey, we've been talking for a fair amount of time, Katie, and I know that there are some people that sometimes like to make a cup of tea or have a cup of coffee or just give their ears a bit of a break. I think we're going to go to a bit of a break. We'll play a song and we'll come back after the break, and we're going to start talking about interest rates, inflation, and other really interesting things. You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
We'll be right back.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Trans Day of Audibility returns to 3CR for its 5th year running. 8 hours of wall-to-wall transgender programming, featuring live music, lived experiences, and dispatches from the front line in the war against reaction. Tune in from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 31st of March. 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 a.m. 3cr.org.au, 3CR Digital.
You're on Radio MMT with Kevin and Katie this week. We just had a short break then, and we heard from X-Ray Specs with Polystyrene at the front, who's my favourite. Seriously, I think she's my favourite punk artist. She's punker than all the other punks, and her song June-Free Adolescence. And I think we're going to go into interest rates now, because there's been another interest rate rise recently, Katie. And this kind of goes into what we're talking about with bank credit and the rest of it. What happens when there's an inflation episode and the Reserve Bank says, we need to combat inflation by raising interest rates? Shall we walk our way through this and see exactly what happens? Why do they raise interest rates? What's the theory behind that?
Well, I mean, there's two stories. There's what happens, and there's what the government and the RBA think they're doing. The theory behind that dates from, actually, nobody acted in accordance with this theory until 1992 in New Zealand, 93 in Australia. But prior to that, this is not something you read in your economics textbooks. Prior to that, there was a whole other sort of interest rate regime, which is very complicated.
Right.
We won't go into. But this thing that's supposed to be, you know, carved in stone and brought down from a mountaintop is not even as old as Seinfeld.
Right.
So
It's older than Australia Day, though, I think, but probably not by very much. Another one of these set in stone traditions that we have. Anyway, I digress.
What they think they're doing is they're putting the brakes on the economy by increasing the price of credit and thereby limiting the supply of credit, because they think, supply and demand and price all balance out and find their equilibrium point. So they think the price of credit is their policy lever that they can use to fine-tune the economy. What they're actually doing, though, is changing the distribution of funds in the economy.
So my understanding is that this is the quantity theory of money that they're applying here, that they're saying that that there's too much money in the economy, and when there's too much money in the economy, it's creating too much demand, and that's pushing the price up. You've got too many people with too much money in their pockets, and they're competing against each other and pushing the price up. So let's reduce the spending capability of people by increasing their interest rates.
Yeah. This is a slightly more modern variant on the old monetarist idea of too much money. This is the idea of the money's too cheap.
And so they're trying to choke spending by increasing interest rates. But it only applies to people with loans. It doesn't apply to, if you haven't got a loan, it's not going to put a choke on you at all, is it?
No. In fact, it in certain circumstances, increasing interest rates can actually increase the flow of government funds into the economy and thereby stimulate the economy. There are distributional effects, as I said, and that increased spending on interest payments will mainly go to wealthy people, obviously, to the detriment of poorer people.
Well, let's step through this. Now, I've actually got a pretty good example, practical example of this in my own life. My daughter has just purchased a property recently, stretched herself to the limit. She's a young mum with a partner. They took the plunge, really, you know, went to their limit. And since then, there's been two interest rate rises. So they're under a bit of pressure. She has to pay the banks more money. That money goes to the banks. What do the banks then do with that money?
Over and above what they need in order to maintain their flow of liquid funds, they just pocket it as profit.
And that profit then goes to what? Shareholders and people with deposits? So, yeah. So we see a transfer of money from people struggling with a mortgage to who are generally younger. If you've got a mortgage, you don't buy shares. If you've got a mortgage, you pay your mortgage off. You don't buy shares. You don't leave money in the bank. The most expensive thing that you'll have is your mortgage repayment. The interest on your mortgage repayment will be more than the interest that you're going to earn if you deposit it. So you're not going to park your money in a bank and earn interest if you've got a mortgage. You'll be applying as much of it as you can to the mortgage. Those people are generally older because they've paid off their houses and richer. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing young home buyers giving their money to the banks, who then give it to older people who aren't under any stress whatsoever. So
So you are limiting economic activity, but only for those at the bottom end of the income distribution.
But you actually
they're the people who are deciding, well, I'm not going to buy a house, or I can't afford to rent, so I'm going to, you know, move back in with mum and dad and sleep on the couch, or, you know, I can't not spend this money on housing, so I have to change my consumption habits and start, you know, skipping meals.
Yeah, whereas the people that the money is going to, they're in the exact opposite situation. They don't have the stress of repaying a loan. So we have an inflation episode. I've watched. I run a diesel vehicle. My diesel, I'm currently paying around $3 a litre for. That's about double what I was paying a month ago. That's the same as a lot of people who are working to pay off their loans, etc. I don't have a loan because I live in my van, because I'm transient. I'm very glad that I am at the moment. Normally, a situation for me, I'd be either paying a mortgage or paying rent. I've already got the stress of my fuel going up. So if you wanted to constrain my spending, well, inflation's already done that. However, the government the Reserve Bank in their infinite wisdom has decided to make it even a little bit harder for me by increasing my mortgage. And then, just to really rub salt in the wound, that money is going to go to people who are already wealthy, don't have a loan to repay, and probably have more options. Probably have an electric car because they can afford one, and can bypass all of this. That increases their spending capability. That contradicts the whole purpose of the exercise, which was to constrain people's spending capabilities. But you're in fact, in this scenario, by raising interest rates, increasing. The wealthier part of the population, their spending capacity has just increased.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you are doing that in extreme enough ways, you end up with an economy where sales of actual goods and services dry up because people simply can't afford them. So there's lots of money, but there's still lots of money sloshing around for, and lots of availability of credit for the wealthier people. So where does that go? Well, you know, that goes into speculative asset bubbles.
Well, it could be that some people can't afford to pay their mortgage anymore. They have to put their property on the market. If enough people do that, the house prices drop, and the people who have got money, the wealthy, pick up a few investment properties.
Under normal circumstances, yes. But at the moment in Australia, we have had 25 years of governments committed to not letting house prices drop. So
yeah,
they will invest in incentives and subsidies of various kinds to see that continues to occur.
Now, we were talking about this earlier. We're talking about the government's ability to price set. And you made the quite salient point that the governments kind of ignore the fact that they have this price setting capability, yet they're doing it anyway, with their policies on negative gearing and the likes for property investors, they're actually involving and altering the market in adverse ways.
Yeah, yeah. So over the last 25 years, according to the Bank of International Settlements Housing Price Index for Australia, inflation-adjusted, that is CPI-adjusted, costs of housing has doubled over the last 25 years. So it's not only the general rise in the price level that we see for everything from, you know, beer to cars or whatever.
Right.
It's over and above that. So this is a massive price setting program on the part of the government to guarantee, again, people at the top end of the income distribution a return on their investment in their housing.
It makes people feel good when their houses become more and more expensive. You know, that they think, oh, wow, I'm doing really well. My house price is going up and up and up.
Yeah, you may be an 80-year-old knocking about by yourself in a 5-bedroom, 2-bathroom house when you'd much rather be living in something more maintainable. But you're thinking, well, this is a valuable financial asset I have here.
Hang on to it. It's just going up and up. That's government policy, which is affecting those price setting. That was predominantly started by Howard. We always like to blame the conservative forces in politics. However, there have been a number of Labor governments in office since then who have done nothing about that. Shorten, to his credit, had a crack at it and probably lost an election on that sort of policy. And I have a sneaking suspicion that Labor might be having another crack at it in the May budget. I reckon it's a hot topic, and I reckon they might have done some polling and realised that it'll probably go down okay. It'd be nice how they do, but you can pretty much be guaranteed that whatever they do is going to be tinkering and nothing substantial. It's going to just, you know, rearrange things a little bit without changing any dynamics. We're going to go a bit off topic here. I'm watching this inflation episode. I'm beginning to wonder, are we watching the end of the capitalist empire in its early death throes at the moment?
I'm afraid not. We might be seeing the end of neoliberalism.
Right.
We certainly see signs of that in the US, where the conservative side of politics have said, well, we're not conservatives anymore. And we don't believe in liberalism anymore. We are now post-liberals, which there used to be a word for that in the 20s and 30s. I think it was very popular in Italy and Germany and some other places, but I can't quite bring it to mind.
Give me the F.
But,
F-A, yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Regardless,
I think capitalism is maybe going to outlast neoliberalism. But
I'm interested to see what's going to happen in the next few months. I've been reading a very good analysis on my Substack. It's simply a person who understands the train from one end of the supply to the other. And Australia is at the end of the supply line for oil. It goes through a whole bunch of other people, and we're right down the end of it. And the analysis that they gave was that up until Easter, we're sort of going to be going okay because a lot of the oil that was going to reach us was already on the water. Even so, I was driving here now, diesel's up over $3 everywhere. Now it's $3.10, $3 heading north. A few weeks ago, I was buying it for $1.70. I've got a mate that works in transport, and he is in charge of managing, you know, some small contractors that might have 5 or 6 trucks and for Woolworths and that sort of stuff. Works for Linfox. And he was telling me last night that these operators are saying, well, we're going to break our contracts. We're not going to deliver stuff. You know, they put forward a case to say that why they need to raise their prices, but the supermarkets are saying no, contract's a contract, and they're going, well, we're not going to run a loss, so we're just not going to deliver. So if you have that kind of disruption where suppliers, like transport's just not going to deliver it because they're going to lose money because diesel has doubled. I spend $5,000 to $6,000 a year in diesel. I know this because I do my tax return. That means I'm going to be spending $10,000 to $12,000 in diesel. Well, I'm not going to I'm going to put my price up. I've got to make up $5,000 or $6,000. I'm small time operator. These guys are talking large figures. I just sort of think that if the supply chains are severely disrupted and Iran has shown no signs of saying that it's going to end this, it's just going to keep on going, and we're at the end of the supply chain, we're going to see our economy turned on its head. It's like, I can't see any way out of this. You'd need Trump to capitulate and say, oh, sorry, which is never going to happen.
Yeah.
Iran have been waiting for this scenario for decades, ever since the Shah was deposed, since before then. They've been waiting for this. And I just can't see how this inflation episode, which is being addressed by raising interest rates, which is just making a bad situation worse.
Yeah. I mean, this is first and foremost a real resource crisis.
Yeah.
Magnified probably, I haven't looked into it, but as in the COVID inflation period, probably magnified by people along those supply chains saying, well, look, here's an excuse that people will accept for us raising our prices over and above the increase to our costs. So there are people making money all the way along the line. And what the government ought to be doing is addressing the real resource crisis, not thinking that raising interest rates is going to somehow magically do it.
They're going to have to get in and regulate. They have to do what governments do in these situations. I'm really interested to see what happens, because I think this is going to get a whole lot worse. I don't listen to mainstream media, and I'm sure that certainly the message that we're getting from the government is, no, everything's okay and supply is all fine. They say everything's okay and supply is fine. That might be so, but diesel's doubled. So we might have supply, but it's twice as expensive as it was before. Everything which is reliant on diesel to be purchased, and that's everything, because it comes by ship or by truck or whatever, train, runs on diesel, those costs have doubled. Where's the capacity in ordinary people, ordinary workers, finding the money that's going to be required to cover those costs? It doesn't exist.
Well, there is one, and it's not a financial problem. It's a real resource problem, and governments in the 1940s understood was, money is the government's tool to manage real resource allocation, and what the government should have been doing is measures, like over the last quarter century or so at least, to say, well, look, we are going to have crises like this increasingly frequently.
Yeah.
So we have to do things that increase our resilience to these kinds of shocks, which is building up buffer stocks of these sorts of imported commodities upon which we're dependent, increasing capacity to deliver goods and services domestically, including crucially public provision.
It's going to have to start interfering. And, so I hear what you're saying. You're saying that neoliberalism, which is calling for small government, is very ill-suited to meet these sorts of crises, which are going to become more and more common. I mean, we've got this one's caused because we've got a maniac running the USA, and he's got allies, and the whole power structure, there's no checks and balances. So you get one madman making these calls, and everything is under stress. Okay, so that's one cause of a what you might call a disruption. But we're going to have environmental disruptions, all sorts of disruptions. This is going to become more and more common. And we're in a situation where the government's just not it's playing small.
The state religion says that the most efficient allocator of resources is the private sector, which is true in the short term, but in the long term, they've made a fragile economy.
Yeah, it's we've been talking about this, and as we've been talking about this, I realise we've run out of time, Katie. We've got to go because Mafal is coming up next, and I think there's some food for thought in that last. It was just a little digression. I'm sure it's on everybody's minds. I reckon we're in for a rough ride, and I'm interested to see how the government handles it. But we've got to go, we'll see you next time. See you later, Katie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage or the quantity theory of money or the loanable...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.